This is episode 5 of a series of podcasts on a French scientist called Lamarck. He's basically the person who first came up with the idea of evolution. His process was a bit strange, but the general idea of that one animal evolves into a different form or into different forms over time is definitely his idea. So he was operating before, during, and after the French Revolution and the time of Napoleon, and he's really the foundation person and worth delving into. He's unknown, so I've had 5 podcasts. This is Peter Hill Explains, where I discuss things scientific. The 5 podcasts so far have been to get the general threads of education, threads of ideas. One is the background, historical background of the French Revolution and what was happening and the scientific power vacuum that he was able to artfully fill and establish his theory of evolution. It's a sort of not A causes B, but B causes A. So he was part of the French Revolution, thrown into a natural history museum, which he helped create. But the collections that he was afterwards pushed him towards this concept of evolution. There's also the story of the various animals, which I think is a worthwhile thing, because these animals, when you look at them, give you a cross-section and insight. So there was a podcast on the polar bears. There's a cross-section on his career going forward, the process of episode, should I say, of him going forward, basically a nobleman, a trainee priest, a soldier who suffered an injury and became an academic who was able to be creative, be able to reinvent an institution to fit the feeling and the values of the revolution. So really natural history museums are revolutionary ideas to go forward. So his careers and then his actual ideas, fourth episode, was about his construction of his ideas, not so much the actual process of it, and we'll get into the ideas in a short while. But the actual step of ideas of looking at complexity, looking at branches, and looking at the concept of evolution, and the boundaries in which he was recoiling from. So he was someone who was against the envisagedness or the idea of extinctions, which were showing up in the fossil records, and the policy and politics. He wasn't as a savvy operator as the extinction with multiple creation events occurring, obviously, after it, a religious view here. So his evolution hit a religious backlash, to be repeated later on with Darwin and the creationists. However, the brand of creationism was a repeat creation, so that God kept on intervening from time and making new forms. I'm just looking at the overall basis of that. So that overall gives an idea of this person. So in this day and age where there's huge numbers of facts to wade through and people, unthinkingly look at a particular version, which is easy to understand, and they sort of assume that that has got all the information correct and structured. That's sort of an old way of looking at it. A new way of looking at bodies of information is to pick strands and work through those strands, as we have done in those 4 episodes. So that leads us up into the next sort of strand of information. The idea with strands is the strands go up, but the strands have cross threads through them of history. And this is can be confusing for people who just like their information in a bowl, so to speak, with the little particles there, and they can eat it. Whereas the actual individual particles of food or information are stitched in through historical consequences and vertically up and all interrelated. And so this is a sort of generally a different approach that you develop as a research scientist. Say if you're doing a PhD dissertation, you will do a literature review. You look at it many different ways and actually spend a bit of time on each topic, trying to develop sophisticated, threaded understanding, expert understanding, rather than sort of commercial, the information being a commercial product as a book or a DVD or something like that, which people who are in consumer street, that's what they go out, they watch a movie, they read a book, they have a conversation, they very rarely get a chance to actually sit down and look at all those threads. So we've had the four threads so far. The next thread is to do with Lamarck into the future. And rather than being remembered as someone who got most of evolution correct and a fundamental component of it possibly incorrect, he's demonised. And he's demonised not because of what he did, but for what people did in his name. So let's look at what his actual theory of evolution is. His theory of evolution had three components to it. He said three principles. One is that during a lifetime, if you exercise an organ, like your brain or an ability or a muscle group or something like that, the body responds to that by increasing the strength or the size of that organ. That's the first principle. The second principle, if you don't use an organ, the body no longer uses that organ and it shrinks. And you can see progressively over time that you can see several vestigial organs, like in your case, in our case, earlobes and appendices, and a fair number of little organs around or floating around in us. One organ I have to note is the third eye. In fact, you've got two eyes plus a third eye, which is a group of retinal photosensitive cells at the base of your brain. That comes from a long time ago with your when you were a fish or something, a very primitive organism, and you needed to sense light. So before the eyes evolved, there was this light sense, and there's still these primitive light cells. So we know this because some very specific eye cancers appear on the retina and on this site, these very similar cells. So these are called vestigial cells. These are or cells or organs which no longer function, or they can be retasked, the gill bones on fish have been retasked in all vertebrates for ears. So we can hear sounds thanks to the impact on our ancient gills. There's a whole series of threads that would point a reasonable person to say that lifetime increase and decrease, use it or lose it, gets actually passed on to your children. That's a third component, that if you do something, it passes on to its children. Now, that seemed reasonable at the time, and we'll say that what the counter theory is. So it's not a binary theory, if I can say a binary way. Charles Darwin said that the size of organs and the use of them is variable, and this process of early death and failure to reproduce of people who have a less favourable organ leads to a natural selection. So rather than actually some sort of mystical positive process of an organ being passed on to the next generation, there's a much more cut and dried place, similar to cultivation or getting a breed together. So there was a massive amount of evidence that this was This was true. So, in a certain sense, that Lamarck was up against a barrier at his time, which was the extinction and God creating animals, and he had another method of creation of animals. So that was later. Moving forward, Darwin was up against a similar evolution versus initial creation, full stop. But he was also up against the lack of knowledge of genetics, the idea of a germ cell line, which is your sperm and eggs, and a soma egg lines, which is the other cells which go around to help the germ line continue forward. So he didn't have that genetics which pointed towards reinforce what Darwin said. But the interesting thing is that what Darwin said is not the full story. But because it's not the full story, it doesn't mean what Lamarck said is the missing part. I think that that's a thing that you often read people, pro-Lamarck people, and indeed there is a pro-Lamarck movement. If you read through something that's pro-Lamarck, you generally find, and this is what we're going to discuss this period, that there's some, sorry, this episode, not period at school, this episode, we'll see that generally if you look, it's linked with Marxism and a whole lot of other areas. This binary, if you're not capitalist, you're communist or something. It's not like that. There are areas that Darwin hasn't quite fully held together, I suppose, to speak. That this is the ability for this open warfare of genes. It really happens at bacterial level, where viruses come in and reprogram evolution, and then genes can code, so the genes of bacteria code themselves to pick out if they've been hacked. You know, they've got anti-hacking stuff, and then they've got de-hacking software, which we've understood. When I say software, it's actually software. It's a chemical software inside the DNA, which comes in and repairs. It's sort of hacking and anti-hacking and all this type of stuff. So very much today, we have a similar analogy with computer programs and hacking and anti-hacking and all this thing going on. And in all of this, gene information can actually transfer between species. We found a little evidence of that, and genes can sort of hop and do all these sorts of things. It's a mad, complex world. And so essentially, it's a slightly different story. It's not A's got a cross against it, B is a story, but there's more to it, and there's more to it. So therefore, A must have been correct because there's more to it. That's not necessarily the way to go. And so there's little evidence that there is some evidence, but there's not strong evidence enough to actually use this as an effective technique, that you can change the genes by of a plant by actually challenging it and putting it into a environment where it adapts as much as it can within the boundaries of its own organs, and then within that own boundaries gradually shifts the boundaries of it. Oh, there's complex evidence, but essentially if you have a pineapple plant and you take it down and grow it successfully down, there's a point where you can't actually take it into a snowfield and grow a pineapple plant. As you go through that, you've got to really watch it, because there's what is seen as a reductio absurdum argument, the sort of argument that politicians use or people use in the community to actually downgrade people's arguments. And I don't know, the people who have these types of arguments come in, make the argument, and when you do the counter argument, they've left because they've won. I don't know, they have this process of winning. Coming back, there's a whole lot of silly experiments where someone said, look, I really don't like Lamarck. Lamarck was the major in certain regions was the major theory at the time. So this person realised, oh, this can't be. And so he got thousands and thousands of laboratory mice, clipped their tails off, and then used it to see if there was any growth of tail. Now, one of the things is the actual experiment was flawed, and thinking he said, Lamarck would have said, well, there will be, if you measure it, it will be just a slight shortening of the tail. This person was going to see, well, has it evolved to no tail whatsoever? And of course, the mice having their tail cut off is nothing to do with Lamarck, because that's not the mice hasn't withdrawn the size of its tail in response to its environment. It hasn't lost, you know, responded to its environment, and the body itself has changed itself. So it's a mad argument. There's heaps and heaps of mad arguments. But we get along to the a point of Lamarck having a new life in with Stalin. And let's pull back a moment. Darwin is the central plank of the excesses of Nazism. Darwin, the acceptance of genetics, genetic theory, is a central point of National Socialism. The gene pool, all this type of theory, given that this has to have been less genetics, discovery of genes and stuff like that, would only have been 40 or 30 years old at the time it was actually first taken up by the Nazis, the actual fall. And so the Russians, which are fighting it, a country based on genetics, the use of genes for a less educated, less intellectually developed Russian administration that Stalin and the Politburo was sort of, it was an easy soft target. If someone could, they didn't understand it in the first place, and if someone could say, look, I found a way, which is, it's not true. And so occasionally, so genetics reigned supreme, but it reigned too supreme. And we have this chap, Lysenko, I don't know how you pronounce it, an agronomist or something like that. Basically a farming, barefoot scientist who goes out there and has a go in the fields to have a go to increase the crop field, the wheat yield. Now, the wheat yield in Russia was a major, major problem, partly because the implementation of a collective farming obviously meant that you had smaller farms, less mechanization, less accumulation of capital, but also it meant that the focus of farming in terms of things I haven't seen is the intelligent use of fertilizer. So if you step back a moment, I've done another podcast on the Haber process. The Germans at the end of World War One was able to do the fundamental process of breaking apart atmospheric nitrogen and making it into ammonia, which is the first step in making fertilizer. So nowadays, I think some staggering effect, 99%, or I've heard other people, scientists say 99.9% of the food we eat, the nitrogen in the food we eat, I find this hard to believe, but has its origin, the nitrogen there, it's got the nitrogen in an industrial process. So the world at the start of World War One faced a looming food crisis that the populations were going to be far too big for us to possibly be able to expand our current farming techniques. So a certain farming efficiency means a certain capital input, certain land use, a certain economy, things that just wasn't going to go that direction. So they could project the food use. Now, this is relevant here. They could project the food use, but then that food use also meant certain other things without fertilizer. So the introduction of fertilizer is a critical aspect. And again, having colonies meant that you had access to the the natural fertilizer, which is a critical point in terms of the actual increase of marginal fertility. France is a little bit different because France is a very highly fertile, like a super fertile country anyway. I don't know whether it's the most fertile country on earth, but it's pretty well up there. I think there's regions of China similar to it. So the West was beginning to be able to develop its food production with artificial fertilizer and techniques and capitalism, whereas socialism went through a series of things worked against them in that terms of that they had a reform where the peasants could own land. I think they're kulaks. I don't know, peasant, sort of middle-class peasants. They got wiped out by Stalin as the low-grade peasants worked on collectives. And because the end result of this is that there was mass starvation. And, of course, mass starvation was also sort of half tacitly encouraged because if you were Ukrainian, I think Ukrainian is the main thing, place, that large starvation meant that you had sort of elimination of people and you could replace them with ethnic Russians. And you have that today with ethnic Russians sitting in the Ukraine. How did they get there? Well, they've got their courtesy of Stalin. But again, the basic credibility of how to increase grain harvests was central in the minds of the Russian Politburo and Stalin, and Lysenko came across. And he had a valid thing that you could do, and you do this to, in Australia, definitely tulips and bulbs. If you want to plant a bulb, just forget it. You've got to store it in your fridge for a while. You've actually freeze it down, put it in the freezer for a while. And that's what he did with the wheats. And it could possibly be believable he did get a good wheat yield. Of course, the weather was another factor involved. So he did things of soaking the wheat, which starts off germination, but also freezing it, storing it in cold conditions, and then sowing it, which is all okay. Like, there were some things which could have a scientific belief, but of course what was happening is that a lot of the scientists and intellectuals were getting strung up and shot and sent to camps, and he reported this great technique. And of course, what better way to do is say this by this person who's aligned more with Marxist theory, which is Lamarck. So Marxist like Lamarck. So Lamarck had nothing to do with Marxism, but Marx in the analysis liked Lamarck. I have to read that there. Karl Marx is a brilliant read. There's chapter 33, which slams Australia, and it's just a great read. It's just rips apart Australia and does quite a good job of it, I actually think. But getting back to it, giving the Marxist theory, having chilled some plants and they've grown big, you don't have to do that again, and so the wheat from the next crop will no longer need this process. So you do this process once and it can go forevermore. And of course people tried to reproduce it, and in general what was done is, rather than rigorous research, there were questionnaire surveys about opinions of different peasants with the commissars about to shoot them, and they said, oh, this is a great yield, and of course the grain didn't increase. People continued to starve, and this gave a cycle of things. And of course, if you have, in both cases, in France in the revolution and in Russia, low food amounts, people are starving and getting desperate, so a good amount of shooting and terror really heats up. And of course, the Russian intelligentsia was beginning to actually work on the theory of genes. So the theory of genes, they didn't know necessarily what DNA and chromosomes were, but there was a theory by an Austrian monk called Mendel. And That theory, I'm only saying this because that theory was easily produced in plants and in animals, fruit flies. And this is interesting because Lysenko called these lousy geneticists fly lovers. Just put them down. And under Stalin, he could name and shame and get them deported and killed. And so you can imagine that whereas scientists sort of stood on the side, stoking World War One and Two by just putting in more ideas, having this system which come out and actually strangle and kill scientists sort of was a big wake-up call. So to this very day, so Lysenko got with Stalin. I think he's still got it with Khrushchev, and essentially no, all the school books were changed to Lysenko. And this is a big thing. Like, if the school books were converted to say one thing, surely that just doesn't stop there. It happens all over the time, all the place. So Lysenko and Stalin, Khrushchev, who went up there, and look, there's two comments, threads I like to go through. One is Stalin. I've just seen a film called, it's supposed to be a comedy, but for me, I didn't laugh. It was just too close to the bone. And that's called The Death of Stalin. And I say this because you always look for things. It's a film by the same people who've produced the very sharp, incisive Veep series. So Veep, most Australians won't know, but but I've watched it because people commented on, showed me, is a story dissecting a vice president of the United States. So a vice president of the United States has all the politics but none of the power going around with it, and it's a sort of very interesting insight. So this same sort of mending and I suppose craftsmanship, building a story and combining, in this case, fact and fiction together. But a lot of it was unfortunately very, very close to the truth, as I have unfortunately learned from chatting to Russian scientists and going through. And this is where people will be working along, but be innocently witness to the wrong information and just taken out and shot. And this was the most confronting aspects of the movie, where something would happen, and before the person could realize it, they'd be shot for learning various things. But it's a very interesting insight into Stalin, and again, I think that the take-home message is sort of the different approach you have to reading it. The very few, well, I know, I'll chat with some of my friends as when they see it. I was about to actually invite some of my cardiac buddies out to come and see the movie at this stage, and they weren't available. I'm glad they didn't see it because it was an inappropriate movie in terms of just too close to the truth. A lot of these people have been in some pretty horrible situations. I should come back to the comment on that, but let's go through it. Then a lot of people take it and then take it as a sort of a consumable offering, sort of like a, I don't know, a pie given to you. Here's a film, take it, and you take it and you don't investigate it anymore. But indeed, I have. And in the scene, there's some relevant aspects to it. In the scenes at the start, a story of a concert recording having to drag people out in the middle of the night and recreate a recording so it can be given to Stalin is a true story, but it happened years before this has happened, really, in a sequence of days. So you can see the story of the license, that if you actually did actually inject, it's like remove, carefully remove, surgically remove sufficient bendable truth, justifiable truth, such that fits the story. Then the story of Stalin actually dying. Now the issue is that Stalin died of a brain hemorrhage, which is in the movie, but he also vomited blood. And the story there is that they suspect that he's been poisoned by warfarin. And again, there's no information, we can't tell it. However, warfarin was making a big hit at this time. It was being aggressively marketed in the United States, fed to the opposite number of Stalin at this time, which is General Eisenhower. So you've got a World War II commander of the Americans, President of the United States, taking warfarin, and they fed warfarin to Stalin, and I'm having a small amount of warfarin because I've actually got a small jet engine, not metallic, but beyond metallic. It's a graphite jet engine part put in my heart, and actually coated with the super material developed for the head of nuclear missiles, re-entry cones of nuclear missiles. I say, oh, we can retask that to give you a super heart part. So I do have a super heart part, but the consequence is I have to take this drug called warfarin, which was developed as a rat poison, a blood thinner. It's actually not, doesn't thin the blood. It knocks out the liver's ability to metabolize or to make vitamin K, use vitamin K, process vitamin K, and convert that to something which helps the blood clot. So when you take warfarin, you begin to bleed more easily. And for the therapeutic range for someone like myself, you've got to get it between a range of 2.5 and 3.5 times more easy bleeding, or 2 and 3, depending on the type of valve you have and what's going on. So it's a wildly available, wildly promoted heart medicine, which is tasteless and ideal for poisoning. And because it's a blood thinner and he had a brain hemorrhage, which is a symptom of warfarin, and vomiting blood, another symptom of warfarin, it's basically a rat poison. Of course, the rats have amazingly evolved to be warfarin insensitive. Good on you, rats. Good on you, Charles Darwin. Of course, if we had thousands of Stalins, we'd eventually get one or two Stalins who are warfarin resistant. So that's interesting. Another interesting aspect of it is that part of the doctor's treatment is actually when he was sick, he's actually putting leeches behind his ears. Is that true? I don't know, but it's just an element of the medieval medicine which has been put aside. And we shouldn't laugh at people bleeding themselves to death. One person who did it was George Washington. He was a great advocate of bleeding, and so when he had a cold, he bled himself and essentially bled himself to death. Is an interesting aspect of it. So one of the things is that I suppose the audience felt very self-assured that sort of madness of people being assessed by association, the associative thinking rather than the analytical thinking, which you're listening to at the moment, which is where I look at things and start to just create a narrative where questions, open questions, and I don't insist you believe it, and when I say it, it's not something that you can pin to my personality. It's just me in the process of analysis. But there they had a very much associative thinking. If you said something, you did something, you were something, therefore you can actually shoot them. It's one of these interesting aspects of associative thinking that A, B, C, bang, you're shot. Now that does exist in small sections of the public service and industries and in groups in Australia. It's not total, but within that area, they say, if you don't believe that, if you don't toe the party line, if you don't say the right things, we can invoke other things, our own associative logic, and actually just blow you away. Or, I was speaking to someone also in cardiac rehab, they happen to be Christian, but doesn't really matter. They were talking about the bad deals that Christians get in North Korea and in other countries. Or another example is that the conversation went in class and these various people from the Philippines and India said, oh, look, you know, it's, or say in India, they had apparently troops coming in the middle of the night to take people away. This reign of terror is just not limited to them. So if you can see in terms of threads, there's Lamarck being used for him and we by association say Lamarck and communism and have this simple thought. There's Stalin, we say, all we've got an Australian constitution where none of this can happen, but it does, and it does happen around the world. But it's not only Lamarck who had this theory of how the parents are treated is how the children will grow. And there's a lot of actually strange evidence for that in the peripherals. But it's not the only mad theory that's out there. And I'll tell you, one, this is a mad theory in the Soviet Union. And, of course, I know a lot of Russian scientists, really the top, at least the laser physicists I work with, were fantastic. But getting back to it, and had a different take and ability to work with mathematical equations, which I found lacking in other scientists. But getting back, there was this belief due to Marxism that all geological features and all components operate on a power of two. So it's either two mountains, one mountain or two mountains, or two ore bodies, or eight rivers, or eight... It's a really crazy theory, and that was the actual main theory. And if you went against that theory, you just got shot. It's true. And I haven't said it very quickly. There's sort of other things that due to Marxism. They had a belief not in continental drift, but the actual Earth shrank, and... Like an apple, a rotten fruit, you get the skin type rotten fruit, and the mountains are the shrinking of the earth. These were various theories. And our story, or my story, is that there was a scientist in Russia who supported the continental drift theory. This in 75. In 75, they were still pouring through the data, nailing it. So after 75, there were satellites which actually could monitor accurately enough continents actually drifting. Back in 75, my father was involved in the Geological Council, and they decided... And back in 75, there were this insane amount of medals going about the place. And again, I think my father was going to get a medal from CSIRO and... I don't know, all these strange metal things. And you don't hear about these days, but you have to understand. In the 70s, it was a time of medals and awards. I don't know how it goes. But he was involved in getting a medal and award for... only as a guest for this Russian scientist. And so this Russian scientist flew out from Russia and went to the UNESCO building. And again... I remember the UNESCO building so well because it's a curved, triangular-shaped building, really unusual, and it seemed really big in Paris at the time, but now I go back and I couldn't find it again, and then I searched it on the internet, and there it was, the UNESCO building. It was definitely the UNESCO building. They went up, gave this medal, and my father felt really, really bad because he was flanked by two... NKVD, KGB officers on the either side, accepted the medal a bit nervously, not looking very, very happy, and gave a very awkward thank you speech and went away. And there was a bit concern about whether you've given that medal to a Russian scientist. Was that the best thing to do? But that tells you even that late... even though the Russians are moving away from Lamarckian stuff, there were other threads of that theory. So I'm just again, trying to talk to develop a more complex understanding by looking at parallel threads through this huge, huge amount of information that the Lamarck, the interaction of Marxism and Lamarck is there. The Chinese had it. I don't know about the Vietnamese, and of course, if you chip away too much about the scientists delving in Lamarck, you can see some communism, you know, sort of socialism in the background there. And of course, in the hands of people who have got this associative theory that if you believe this and that, therefore that, and therefore you can't have an opportunity, and the people can really respond to being blocked with the unfairness of this, and it is unfair to look at it. So Lamarck is still alive and still believed, but how it's understood, I think it should be understood as a legitimate step theory towards a modern understanding of evolution. We should be sentient that, or be aware that our commitment to Darwin is also a political commitment, and that as we're preparing to move on beyond Darwin with something called epigenetics. So episilicon, that's the one after silicon. So if they knew that there was something afterwards, and not quite what they call epi, so we're in the epigenetics as we're beginning to actually unplug the secrets of genetics to know that there's more to it. So to realise that our very much focused on Darwinism, the Darwin theory of natural selection, all that type of stuff, our limitation, our glasses is very much fused by the political climate for it, and our political, the hurt people feel. I mean, a lot of scientists felt quite hurt by the Stalinist purges against scientists. That's really coloured us, and so that's sort of, we're teaching a certain aspect of it and not moving forward. And there's also political things that are pushing to us. And so Lamarck should be not seen as Lamarck should be seen as Lamarck. What he said is what he said, and it's either it's supported by evidence, and it's or it's not. And we should also be critical of the experiments and the thinking and the speech which disposed of it almost equally badly. Sort of chopping off mice's tails is sort of allowing people to critique it and stuff like that. Oh, look, there's other stories of, I think during World War One, there was a Lamarckian scientist who in Austria, and there's a story of his beliefs and whether he'd fabricated results in a world of where you publish results and you just get other labs to see if you can reproduce it, and if they can't, they go, what's going on? I don't know what's going on. But it's where people actually have put results up and have press conferences on it. It becomes a power struggle. I think with the internet and large and sufficient people like myself who just take a less partisan, a more analytical rather than associative view, it's a gentler place for science. And I think we actually move our way forward. So that's the hopefully the end story. I hope this is not an episode 6 about Lamarck. So just to recap, Lamarck, use it or lose it, which we agree with, but then that can be transferred into future generations. Seems a fairly credible explanation of the evidence, as you've seen, but we live in a world now that a credible explanation has to be put up against other credible explanations and experimentally looked at. And then in its history as a step towards Darwin, which is a step to our new area, And the fact that people have gone back and taken Lamarck has really frozen our view to look beyond genetics. In the meantime, keep on doing science, keep on thinking science, and at the end of the day, teach some science.